morning, and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm one of your Tuesday Morning Show hosts, Phil Huff. I'm back in the saddle after a couple months of recovery from knee surgery. We are pre-recording this interview with Casey McCormick, regional non-game biologist for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, and Joel Sauter, biologist also for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. And we're going to talk mostly about a fisher recovery project, but let's launch with this. Casey, Joel, let's start with a little bit more of an introduction for each of you. What you do for the agency, what your background is. Casey, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I, like Joel, as you'll hear, I'm a diversity wildlife biologist for Idaho Department of Fish and Game. I've been in that position for 5 or so years now, and with the department for 10 or so years now. And what we do with the diversity program is focus on a lot of our non-game species or species we don't hunt and fish for. And that can range anywhere from the fishes we're going to talk about today to insects such as bumblebees or butterflies or monarch butterflies to songbirds to amphibians, freshwater mussels, almost anything you can think of. So our work is pretty diverse. As far as how I got in the program, it's actually kind of funny. I started as a paid volunteer, actually, or a seasonal technician working on the multi-species baseline initiative project that was kind of with fishers being one of the focal species of that project, about in 2014 or 2015. And I'm kind of worked my way up from there. So.
Yes, I remember the project well, and your predecessor, one of them, Michael Lucidus, I recall, was running that, and he had a passion for slugs.
Yep. He still does. I'm good friends with Michael still, and was happy to work with him. And he's still looking for slugs, as far as I know, too, among many other species.
they are out there. We're going to chat a little bit about the multi-species baseline and how it led up to this. But let's go ahead, Joel. Why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners and tell them about what you all do for the agency?
Yeah, Casey covered it real well. We actually have the same job. We're just in different regions of Idaho Fish and Game. So he covers the Panhandle region. I cover the Clearwater region. I said we work on our diversity species. So basically all the things that we don't hunt or fish might fall to Casey or mine's responsibility. I've happened to have been in the Clearwater region here in the Lewiston office for 23 years now. And have worked on a wide variety of things, almost too many to list in a short program like this.
So I'm sure the Fisher program took a lot of hands to carry out. We're going to talk about the partnerships and all, but what were your various roles with the Fisher reintroduction, Casey, Joel?
Yeah, I'm sure Joel will go into more detail there. It definitely was a large effort, and we are just two of many folks that contributed. My hand with it, really, because I'm based out of Panhandle here. We can get to some other details later, but I helped set up some cameras that we're putting up to look at any changes we might see from the source population we're pulling these animals from. And I also kind of helped scout out the location of the release site for these fishers. And now, kind of on the back end, my role is going to be more monitoring them after they've been collared and kind of understanding their habitat use is kind of be the main roles I'm with, among many other little things, but a lot of moving pieces, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joel?
Yeah, as for my role in this, I guess this is kind of partially my brainchild. I've been involved in the fisher world for quite some time at this point. And this has been an idea that's been perking in the background for many years, trying to augment this population to just increase the overall population size of fishers in the Northern Rockies. So me and our fur bearer coordinator have been talking about this for a few years, is Corey Mosby. And about a year or two ago, we really started making progress on it, working with project partners to find the funding, get the permission to make sure that everybody's on board with the goals of the project, and get the green light to put animals on the ground.
Yeah. So fish are probably one of the lesser known species and less frequently encountered. I have to say, I've seen a lot of animals in the wild with the long distance hikes that my wife and I have taken and are tromping around North Idaho. And I've seen a dead one in a trap, and I've seen lots of photos and prints, but I've never seen a live fisher. And I think that's true for a lot of folks. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, well, I think what your experience right there tells one of their main characteristics is they're quite cryptic, so they're mostly solitary, cryptic, hard to come across. So even if they might be in a certain area, you're unlikely to stumble across them by any means. They are member of the mustelid or weasel family, so you can kind of think of them as a big bigger weasel in a way. Also related to like wolverines, otters as well are in that same family. They range in size with the range from about 4.5 pounds up to about 13 pounds, females being smaller than males. And they're a mid-sized carnivore, of course, too. So they usually hunt smaller species such as squirrels and chipmunks, rabbits, and things like that. And are typically associated with more of our forested habitats, which is why we're kind of working in the Clearwater and Panhandle regions where they're more suited. So.
Now, am I recalling right? Are they somewhat of a porcupine specialist?
Yes, they are known for that as well. Yeah, they are. I think they're probably quite good at predating upon many different species. But yeah, they do are known to have a knack for predating upon porcupines as well. So,
Yeah.
whether we have how many we have in the Panhandle, I don't know. I bet you there are
No.
even more squirrels out there right now, would be my
Right.
guess.
Yeah,
But
I imagine as opportunity goes, they don't come across as many, but you have to have a lot of respect for an animal that's going to look at a porcupine and all those quills and think food.
I think that family in general, mustelids, are kind of known for their fearlessness in a way, and everything from martens to fishers to wolverines are known to take on quite this prey species and or fend off other predators they might be competing with. So yeah, they're pretty amazing what they're capable of.
So as elusive as they are, and with a position sort of in that mid-range of size in the mustelid family, I'll just be real direct. Why do we care about them?
Oh, because they're
Go
a
ahead, Joel.
wonderful creature. They're part of the natural heritage that we have here in Idaho. It's one of the things that if you do see one when you're out in the woods, that is a highlight that you will remember the rest of your life. I've seen two wild free roaming fishers, and both of those are emblazoned on my memory forever. So they're one of the things that make Idaho special.
Yes, absolutely. And I asked that question with a somewhat tongue in cheek, knowing that I share that passion for maintaining all things wild. But in another way too, let's talk about their role in the ecosystem and why it's important to reestablish them in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains.
Yeah, so the historic distribution of fishers probably spanned most of North Idaho. They're associated with our mesic mature forest types. So that's going to cover most of the Panhandle, all the Clearwater. Once you get too far south of there, they start to taper off. We have seen them, in the salmon region, and we've seen them around McCall and a few down into the Sawtooths. That's getting more towards fringe of their range. But back in the day, in the early 1900s, 1920s, 30s, with the war on predators and some of the habitat loss that we had from the great catastrophic fires, fishers were virtually extirpated from Idaho. And I say virtually extirpated because there's a pretty cool story there, but we may not have time to get into it. The end result was sometime in about the 40s and 50s, we thought fishers were extirpated. All the seasons were closed, and we thought we didn't have fishers in Idaho for a long time. Then, in about the 60s, Idaho Fish and Game did a reintroduction effort and brought in fishers from outside of Idaho and dropped them off in Elk City, Powell country. And that started our first fisher kind of core population. And then in the 90s, Montana did a similar effort. Where they released fishers into the Cabinet Mountains on the Montana side. Those eventually spread into Idaho. And that's kind of resulted in our two core populations, the Cabinet Mountains in the north, the St. Joe, Clearwater, Nez Perce population to the south. But right in the middle of that are the Coeur d'Alene Mountains, and that's where these fishers are headed.
So going back to the multi-species baseline study 2010 to 14, the organization I worked for at the time, the Friends of Scotch and Peaks Wilderness, was one of the partners, and we were recruited early by Michael to help put out game cameras in the West Cabinet Mountains. And I remember the first season, one of the fantastic results we had were photos of at least four fisher, distinct individuals, including a mom with two kids, there in the West Cabinet Mountains. And it was exciting because the thinking at the time that he relayed to us was that they had been extirpated from the cabinets. And there was some evidence then that there was a reproducing population that, as the study went on, it was determined from the genetics, the first samples collected were likely descendants of a crossbreed of the reintroduced species from the 70s, 80s, 90s, as well as potentially some from Canada. But it was exciting news. And that study, if I recall right, also showed zero or close to zero evidence of fissures in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains. So there was this gap. And talk more about how the MSBI study comes into play in the design urgency for the reintroduction project now.
Well, actually, that project was aptly named. It's a baseline initiative, right? So when we went out there, or when Michael set up that project, one of the goals were to kind of answer some of those unknown questions. And a lot of species, including fishers, as well as gastropods and other ones that were included as part of that project, we didn't really have a baseline to know what distribution they had in Idaho, or at least North Idaho at the time. And so that was a very thorough study where cameras were virtually, it was basically placed across the grid, across the whole entire panhandle, all the way from down the St. Joe up to the Canadian border. And in that, we were able to get a really good feel on where fissures might be occurring in North Idaho. And that's where we first got the inclination that they were fairly prevalent in the cabinets. As you mentioned, the genetics did point to that haplotype that came from the Midwest, I believe, when they did that reintroduction in Montana. But yeah, and so in that time, as like you said, the Coeur d'Alenes were a very obvious gap there in areas where it should be very suitable fisher habitat. Joel's actually done some work in the past modeling fisher habitat, as well as some other folks, and everything points to the fact, in addition to just gut feeling, that that's very ideal habitat for fissures to occur as well. So it's been kind of on our radar as being a gap, one of the gaps in Idaho where fissures should occur since that study. And I would imagine it was probably a contributing factor to pursue something like this, like Joel had mentioned earlier. There might be other areas as well where this goes, but Coeur d'Alenes are the obvious one, especially between those two main population centers, where they should occur. So yeah, it was kind of a whether it was like a main factor in the whole thing, it was definitely opened our eyes to a potential effort to bring them back to where they should be.
It sure seems like an area where they ought to be.
Yep.
So let's take a look at the project, an overview of what everything entails with the project, the goals, the approach, where we're at.
Yeah, so this is a uniquely collaborative approach to improving the conservation status of a species. We're partnering with trappers across Idaho, particularly in the Clearwater region, because that's our source population, through a grant that the Trappers Association received from the Idaho Fish and Game Commission. Basically, that's paying trappers for the successful delivery of a live trapped fisher to us. So we've provided trappers with cage traps. They have an area that they're familiar with where they think they can catch a fishers. They put out these traps. They check them every day. When they capture an individual, they have our technician on speed dial, give them a call. We arrange to pick it up and take it off their hands as quick as possible and get it into our holding facility. So we end up holding these fishers for, we don't like to hold them too long, up to 2 weeks. But the reason we hold them is we've previous reintroductions like this have shown that when you release them in waves with multiple animals being released at the same location, essentially at the same time, they do better in terms of staying there. They just don't scatter to the wind. Mustelids, the must from their name talks about how they smell. They communicate by scent. And so when they're dropped up in an area and they don't smell anybody else, they kind of just go looking for a friend. But if you have multiple individuals that go out at the same time, then that communication's still there. They're like, oh, she's there, so I want to be here. That's particularly what the males would say. And so that's why we're kind of bunching these up into waves of releases. We'll hold them in the facility for about 2 weeks. We will get a good number of animals. We have a processing day where we put them all under anesthesia, collect some samples and measurements off them, put satellite tracking collars on them, wake them back up. The next day, they get driven up to the panhandle to Unit 4 and are turned free in their new home.
So where are they coming from? Central Idaho or
Throughout the Clearwater region, we're,
throughout? Okay.
covering a lot of different areas within the Clearwater region, trying to not take
Yeah.
too many out of any one area.
Sure. So it sounds like you're taking the steps to make sure that they don't, like the grizzly bears that have been reintroduced in the cabinets, try to wander home back home to Glacier.
Yeah, we're doing everything we there's a we want them in this mountain range. It doesn't help us
Yeah.
if they go back to the St. Joe or go
Yeah.
north and join the ones in the cabinets. So we're doing everything we can,
Yeah.
but I mean, animals, working with animals, they have minds of their own. We've actually had one individual that's migrated south or south and crossed I-90, and it's kind of down in the St. Joe where we don't really want him, but once you let him go, you have no control of the
Yeah.
situation in terms of where they end up.
So how many critters have you released so far?
So this
Started 11 or so is what we started with, and then the Coeur d'Alene tribe that we're working with as well had also actually collared some fishers in the Joe just to release in the same locations, St. Joe, I mean, so we can learn a little bit more how they're using those habitats. But those animals weren't moved, so.
Okay. And the goal is to release more over the next year or two.
Yeah, I think we're going to kind of see how this year goes, but I think as of right now, we're definitely planning on full steam ahead to at least do one more year of capture and re-releases, and with the goal of between 10 and 15 animals. And we're going to kind of see how that goes and determine whether that'll be the final season or if another one might be needed, but at least one more year for sure.
And how will you eventually monitor success? What does a successful outcome look like in terms of measuring the project?
Yeah, so we already have kind of a monitoring strategy for fishers across Idaho. We do use remote cameras and measure a metric called occupancy. So we can estimate the percentage of a landscape that is occupied by that species. And so right now, our estimates say that there are virtually no fishers in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains. And we're hoping that at the end of this project and a few years after it, after they've had a couple of seasons of breeding and individuals being born there and dispersing and creating new home ranges, when we use that standardized protocol, we'll be able to detect individuals and be able to show that we have increased the occupancy of fishers in that range. And then because we're handling every fisher that's going into this population, we can do some more interesting investigations. We know all the genetics of the individuals that we put in there. We'll be able to tell who bred with who, who's had babies, who hasn't. If we need to get to that granular detail, we'll be able to do that. That's a few years down the road.
So I'm assuming then you'll be able to tell if they've crossbred with nearby populations, and is that a goal or a hope for?
Yeah, ultimately down the road, and now we're talking 5 years or more probably at this point. Yeah, the one of the reasons we chose this location was it fills a gap between our two core populations. So, always having better genetic conductivity between your populations is a good thing. And so, yeah, we would love to see 10 to 15 years from now, if we look at the genetics, we can say, look, we didn't move this individual into the Coeur d'Alene, this haplotype of this genetic signature. So by now detecting it there, we can prove or conclude that we're seeing greater connectivity and breeder crossbreeding between our different populations, which will make everybody more healthy.
Now, eventually down the road, and I have to apologize, I was going to check this before the interview, but I know as late as, or as recently as at least 10 years ago, it was still legal to trap fishers in many parts of Idaho. Is there still a season on that, or has that gone away?
No, that actually has not been a season, open season for fishers in Idaho. The part of this, and whether it'll come to this point or not, but there is interest from some of our partners that are trappers, or Idaho Trapping Association, and eventually potentially having a fisher season down the road. And if whether that's possible or not, it'll kind of depend. But this project could be something that could make that happen if the populations were. We think could sustainably handle a harvest like
Okay.
that. But no, there hasn't been an open
Okay.
trapping season for fishers, so.
Okay, that's good to know. But so if this is successful, are there other areas that you're looking at reintroducing? I remember too the multi-species baseline study indicated a very, very low number of fisher in the Selkirk. I think there was some presence, but on the fingers of one hand, if I remember right.
I think we might be, we did identify that, and that's something we'd thought about when we were identifying the first locations to maybe try this, and we talked about the Selkirks. So it we is something we it is another gap in a potential fisher habitat where they could occupy that area in theory. I'd say it's a little premature now to know whether we'll go to that step or not. Right now we're definitely concentrated on the Coeur d'Alenes. But yeah, you're right that there during that same MBI project that we didn't identify the Selkirks as being kind of a gap in fisher range in Idaho as well. So
So perhaps down the road.
potentially, yeah. We're still learning a lot with this project. So
Yeah.
something that's been done really done at least by us in Idaho before, and especially with this new collar technology, we can really kind of have a better idea of what's going on.
Yeah,
So
it's exciting. Tell us a little more about the new collar technology.
yeah, so these are satellite collars. It's kind of the cutting edge of what you could do with animals this small. The common limitation is how big of a collar you can put on an animal. When you've got a moose or an elk, you've got a lot of battery or weight budget to deal with. But that technology that was pioneered on bigger species has now trickled down to our smaller species like fishers. And so, yeah, basically it's got a GPS unit that collects GPS coordinates of where it is, and it relays that to a satellite connect, not a unit, but a device that connects two satellites, and it beams that information up off to a satellite in space, and then it's emailed to us at our desk. So it's pretty impressive technology.
And how long do the batteries last? I guess it would be the batteries that would determine the length of the life of the collar.
That is based on their programming. You could stretch them longer if you want. We're going for very short, intensive monitoring. The idea with the collars was principally to make sure that we weren't having any undue capture and relocation mortality effects. And so we're, and in that time where we have collars on them, we're trying to get information about the habitats they're using, trying to understand better what they use for den sites and rest sites. And to get that information, you kind of need really intensely collected information. So basically, we've chosen to use these batteries intensively. Basically, they're going to be expired by July or August when these collars come off. And then we
Okay.
will go into the field and try to recover the collars at that point. Because there's some other data that's stored on board the collars that we can also use that will help us understand their behavior better.
So you get really good intensive data for 3 quarters of a year.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Interesting.
There's actually another part of the project that folks might not be aware of that's kind of a main goal as well, as in addition to moving these animals, is that this collar technology, like Joel just alluded to, will give us probably our best knowledge to date of what type of den and rest sites these animals are using in the Northern Rockies. Like they do know, have a good idea in Canada or the Sierra Nevada and California, for instance, where they've done a little bit more fisher work in the past. But a large part of this project, or at least a secondary goal of the project, is to go to these sites after we get the collars and actually collect very intensive habitat data there that will hopefully help forest managers such as the Forest Service kind of know how they might want to manage their forests that will benefit, or at least benefit, or at least not harm fishers in the future to retain those necessary den and rest sites. And so that will be a large part of the project following the fisher releases in the next coming years as well. So.
So yeah, so they're den and nest sites. Do they have a preference for some kind of habitat? I'm seeming to recall there's some link between a healthy fisher population and old growth.
Yeah, I think old growth or at least mature forests, and basically what you're going to need are large trees that have large diameters, or snags that allow for cavities for them to be able to den in and have their kits be born in and protected in. And so yeah, old growth is probably definitely great habitat for them, or at least mature enough forest that has those kind of characteristics. And so that's another reason why the Coeur d'Alenes that are dominated by, this cedar, grand fir, kind of wet enclosed forests with large trees should provide this ideal habitat they need for den and rest sites. So.
So in terms of forestry practices, also I'm seeming to recall patches rather than complete total clear cuts, so they can have some connectivity or at least not huge gaps between the mature forests.
Yeah, gaps, or just at least be cognizant of leaving some of those patches behind. And like I said, we don't think it necessarily has to be old growth either. It just as long as
Mature.
they retain some mature forest on the ground on the landscape. So.
Well, I know there'll be folks listening who had been part of the multi-species baseline who would be more than eager to volunteer. If you need volunteers, are you looking for more volunteers?
This is a unique project. We are using volunteers. The volunteers are our trappers, and those are principally located down here in the Clearwater region where our source population of fishers is. So right now we just don't have a great need for a volunteers to get involved up in the Coeur d'Alene where these animals are being released.
Okay. Well, so as we come to the close of the main questions we have, before we go through final thoughts, if someone tuned in late listening and wants to delve in more to this, where's the best place for them to go for more information on the project?
I would recommend our website is actually a great resource and has some articles there with some videos that are explaining the project. We're also hoping to continue to put out some more media and videos that are talking about these other portions, the camera portion detecting occupancy that Joel mentioned, as well as some of the habitat data collection I'll be doing as well. Those aren't out yet, but they will be coming over the next year or two. And we also have Idaho Fish and Game Facebook page and Instagram that'll have blurbs about those stories as well. So.
Lots of places. I know, Joel, you're becoming a media star.
Media star, I guess. I
Yeah.
was happened to be highlighted on that video. And so yeah, it's le leading to things like this.
Just one step short of being an Instagram influencer,
Hope not. I
but
have too much gray hair for
final thoughts. Anything more you'd like to talk about? Joel, you go first. We'll give Casey the last word.
I just am impressed by the partnerships we've been able to pull this project together between partnering with the Trappers Associations, Coeur d'Alene Tribe, the Commission, Forest Service, Corps of Engineers. Everybody's really excited. I mean, I've been in the agency a long time at this point, and rarely do you get a chance to do kind of proactive conservation. We're often more reactive. When something bad happens, we try to make the best of it. Here, we're actually have a chance to expand the total number of fishers in Idaho and make their populations more robust. And that's a really cool thing to be a part of.
Excellent. Casey?
Second, everything Joel said just said, of course, it's been great. It has been like it's amazing when you get to work with these different partners, like Joel mentioned, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Coeur d'Alene Tribe and folks of the Forest Service getting information from them as well, just like how helpful everybody is. And that's usually the case. We're really fortunate in this field that most folks are passionate with what they do and easy to work with and able to make cool things happen because they care about what they do. But in addition to that, it's just a really interesting project that kind of hopefully has all benefits and no downsides, we're hoping, right? Where we can potentially benefit the species, hopefully provide a species in a new area for generations to come, bolstering and making sure that they remain there on the landscape.
Excellent. Well, if listeners are just tuning in, or
Just fortunate to be part of the project, so.
excellent. Well, thank you. If listeners are just tuning in or tuned in halfway, we are on the morning show talking about the Fisher Recovery Project in the Coeur d'Alene Mountains with Casey McCormick, the regional non-game biologist for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game up here in the Panhandle, and Joel Sauter, who does the same thing for the department down in the Clearwater. I want to appreciate you both for coming on the show today, taking time. If there's updates, we'd love to hear them in the future. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes.
Thanks for the
Thank you.
interest.
With me in the studio now, we have two guests. We're going to do a live interview with folks from the Kinnickso Land Trust. Good morning, Kara Johnson and Brianna Larson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks
so,
for having us.
You bet. So we're here to talk about the Kinnexu Land Trust and a couple specific things going on of interest, it being spring and the opening of the Astor Garden Center, the grand opening, and we're going to talk a little bit about that and ongoing educational programs. Who would like to kick us off with a little bit of background on the Kinnexu Land Trust, what the brief history and mission for the organization are?
Well, I guess I can start. I'm Bree, and I'm the director of education. I run our education programs. And KLT, we do amazing things. We love to care for land and our waterways and connect our community to it. So that can look like private land conservation, our nature immersive education, and our different community partnerships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. KLT, one of the biggest projects was the Pine Street Woods, which is like these beautiful lowland woodland, you know, trails that we all used for a long time. And we're kind of like, you know, open to the public to use up and through there. But as, you know, with privatization of land and then, you know, people selling big tracts of land, those can go away all of a sudden. But Kinnexu Land Trust actually purchased that the landowner really, you know, working closely with it, you know, excited to see something be protected, their land be protected into perpetuity and the public be able to enjoy it. And so now we have the Pine Street Woods, which would probably have just become housing, you know, but now we all have access to that.
It's such a wonderful
place.
Wonderful resource.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Which helps people value land by connecting to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think everyone locally who likes to get outdoors has some experience with the Pine Street Woods, and we always have listeners who are just tuning in. So it's a great opportunity to remind them of the wonderful assets or introduce them to the wonderful assets. And there's some great stuff going on at KLT. The grand opening for the Astor Garden Center was this last weekend. I had the opportunity to stop and visit by.
A
wonderful event.
Yes, it was. It was such like one of these beautiful, you know, standpoint. What a community. It was so fun. Saturday was a great day. Started out really rainy. And then, you know, all these friends brought their pop-ups for us to use. And it turned out to just be a beautiful, beautiful day. And so many people came out. It was so good to see everyone. And lots of plants found homes. And lots of wonderful contacts are being made constantly there. It's just creating a really neat network. OPA Food Truck was there. And some people were doing crafts for kids and adults. It was a really fun day.
Yeah, it was awesome. Hopefully you'll redo that for folks who didn't make it Saturday.
Oh, yeah. We'll have events is definitely in our future.
Yeah. So tell us, everyone, about the Astor Garden Center, what KLT has done.
Well, Astor Garden Center is just a beloved nursery that was created by Karen and Paul Olson. And it went up for sale last year. And And Kinnexu Land Trust purchased it late in the year. Karen and Paul and, you know, the community, all of us are so happy to see it, the Astor Garden Center, just continue, because what they have created there is just such a special place. And now with Kinnexu Land Trust taking it over, we can just carry on what they've been doing and add to it to really expand, you know, towards like the Kinnexu Land Trust mission with a lot of really true to type Idaho native plants, really good plants for rewilding, not only natives, but things that support all life here, the birds and the insects and the people and you know, beauty. Beauty is wonderful medicine for us all. Now that Astor Garden Center is part of the Kinnexu Land Trust, it also really helps fund KLT. It's kind of like the animal shelter thrift store. Mm-hmm. So it really gives us a kind of a much more steady revenue stream to help fund it. So now when you shop at Astor Garden Center, you're supporting the land trust and protecting large tracts of wild places.
Mm-hmm. So wonderful to be able to continue offering the plants, the native plants, the opportunity for funding, also for room for classes and events.
Yes, exactly. An education center. We're really working to create like a nature center sort of experience there when you come in. So we're we're creating signs and educational materials that just when you walk through on your own, you'll be able to learn about the native birds and which plants are host plants for this butterfly or that butterfly. And also we have just space to host teachers, to have some of our folk school classes there, to have events. We really want to have it to be, like a third space, people might call it, just to come and be,
And also Connecticut Land Trust moved their offices, I understand.
Yes.
So
yeah.
New office space.
Uh-huh. It's beautiful. If you haven't been, stop by and visit, because that back garage shop that was there was like an old a shop for working on log trucks. And Paul and Karen used it for just their, a garage type of shop. And so when KLT took it over, Katie Cox, she's an architect. So she designed the inside, and we used the milled wood from Pine Street Woods to make like a tongue and groove interior walls. And it is beautiful. Her design is amazing. The space is so gorgeous. It's like a really cabiny, really light, beautiful, beautiful space. And that's where KLT's offices are. So now it's just now people can visit the land trust either through the garden center or there at the office. It's much more accessible. We can host people, host events, and really connect with the community more, because it's really about community. So, yeah.
So tell us about the hours of operation when it's open. I want to come down and get a plant for my garden. When can I come?
Yeah. So the garden center, Astor Garden Center, is open every day. And it's 9 to 5, Monday through Saturday. And then on Sundays, we're doing 10 to 4. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be open for on Sundays, at least through the end of June. And then we'll just see how it goes. But we want to be open every day during this like garden
spring season. People visit garden centers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I noticed native plants and landscaping plants. Mm-hmm. Any stuff for the vegetable garden?
That's not our major focus right now. There's so many people here in town that do that really, really well. Red Wheelbarrow Produce, amazing vegetable starts. All Seasons, they have lots of great vegetable starts. I think what we will have some, but what we will do in the future is we would like to have vegetable starts that come from seeds that are locally produced seeds that have the genetic adaptations to this place. Mm-hmm. And there are some amazing seed breeders right here in our area that are oriented towards Sandpoint and our little neck of the woods, that are creating strains of squash and tomatoes and all sorts of interesting things that are for this place. Yeah. And so those is what we are. Yeah. We'll probably specialize in that.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, Diane Green was a pioneer in developing garlic suited specifically to our area.
Yeah, and her snow pea, her summer snow pea. For years she's developed a snow pea that now she has beautiful peas in August, when the rest of us, our pieces are long
They're gone.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to get some of those in. So,
definitely. Yeah.
Well, let's turn our attention to some of those educational events that might take place there or on the field campus at Pine Street Woods. Brianna, Bree, which do you prefer? Bree?
I usually say Brianna, but as people get to know me, it shortens, and that's okay.
Okay.
So.
Well, Brianna, tell us what's happening in the educational world. What's going on right now? What's coming up?
Well, I'm in the throes of summer camp, accepting students, and it's sad that I can't accept everybody. We get twice the amount of applicants as we can receive. So I'm planning a canoe trip, canoe expedition on the Pend'Oreille River, and we're going to go all the way to the border of Canada. I'm so excited.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I have an all-girls teen trip and a co-ed trip in August.
Where are you going to start? Where are you going to put in?
We're going to put in just around Usk.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about portaging around the Albany Falls Dam.
Well, we do have to portage around the Box Canyon Dam.
Right. Yeah.
So that'll be exciting. A little drive, I suppose. But other than that, it's going to be a blast.
Now, will you actually be able to get into Canada with the
I do
border?
Not No, yeah. I don't intend to take anybody to Canada. There's a dam there.
Yeah.
So we would technically have to portage around that, but we just end right there at the border, boundary dam.
Probably not so much the getting into Canada, but the getting back out.
Absolutely.
With a bunch of wet river rats going, yes, we really do belong here.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm in the throes of that. And we have folk school, our K'nixu folk school coming up. Classes still rolling out. I have a class this weekend with a card weaving.
That's you that's teaching that,
that is
right?
Me, yeah.
I'm going to be there, by the way.
Are you
yes,
really?
I can't wait. Yes. It's really beautiful. Brianna teaches this really special tablet weaving. Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's tablet weaving. And I make straps and bands, guitar straps and shoelaces, anything that needs a strap, you know.
It's called tablet weaving because that's what you use for the weave?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, little cards like cardstock, and they're called tablets, and
so you don't end up with a Kindle at the end.
No, okay. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. No Kindles. Yeah, we have a lot of programs going on.
Oh, good.
As usual.
And so some of these sound like they're geared for children, school age, the summer camp, and some for adults. Is that right?
Yes, yes. Summer camp is for the kids. Field trips coming up for all ages, kindergarten through high school. And then with the folk school is all the adult classes because the adults crave it. Every time they come on a field trip, they're like, can you do this for me, please?
Yeah.
So
tell us, some are taking place in the Garden Center and some at the Pine Street Woods, or are they all in one location?
They take place in two different locations.
Okay.
So if it's going to be a messy class, it's going to be at the barn at the Sled Hill, their big red barn there. And if it's going to be a nice little weaving class or something, sewing or stitching, it'll probably be at Astor Gardens.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so where can people sign up?
People can sign up at K'nixu.org. And and they can select our nature education tab and find all of our classes and dates there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is there still a blacksmithing club?
I don't think the club is happening right now, but he might kick it off again for the summertime. Yeah, I'll have to ask Nick Belfry, who's our blacksmith teacher. Mm-hmm.
Very nice. So what else is coming up? What other events and activities are on the horizon line?
Let's see. We are at K'nixu Land Trust here in town at the Astor Garden Center on May 6th. There is the Live Give 7B, which... we're going to be hosting the evening event. I think it's like the culminating event of that 4 days of giving to nonprofits. So we'll have a little evening after hours shopping at Astor Garden Center, and we'll have we're planning it right now, but it'll be a fun evening, similar to the opening day.
Yeah. And what date is that?
That's the 6th of May.
On the 6th. Okay,
yes.
Great.
That. And then we'll do, at the Garden Center, we're also going to have a special Mother's Day event. We'll flowers and tea and, yeah, so you'll hear more about that soon, too.
Yeah, very nice.
Mm-hmm. And then we have our Trails and Tales walk starting up in June. So June 1st, we partner with the library, and our interns, they come in and do a story walk with kids of all ages at Pine Street Woods. And so come June 1st, people will get the dates and times for that to join.
Very good. Well, we'll have to wait in suspense. Maybe have you back on just before June 1st to give a sneak preview, or afterwards when you can actually announce it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, what other things would you like to talk about before we close out the interview?
I think we're just... we're just really excited about this new chapter we're at our new spot, and we're really excited for the Garden Center and just how amazing it's been to, it's really been a really community effort. So many people have come and volunteered and helped, and Paul and Karen have mentored us into, they're continuing to be there all the time and helping us to know how to do this.
Paul and Karen, the previous owners.
The previous owners of Astor. Yeah,
they looked very happy on Saturday.
They're just about the nicest people you'll ever meet. They're the best. Yeah.
I think they had a good time. They felt comfortable passing their legacy on this way.
I think they were really glad to see it stay a garden center because you never know when there. Yeah. I mean, other people may have just built something else there.
That's a prime location in town.
It really is, right in town center. Yeah.
I think we gave away the location earlier, but for folks who want to get
there.
Yeah,
it's at 924 Superior. It's directly next door to the drive-through beer store. That's how most people understand it. Yeah.
That's an easy way to remember it. Yes. Well, if you've just tuned in, we're talking this half of the hour with Kara Johnson and Brianna Larson from Kinnickzu Land Trust about the Astrid Garden Center and upcoming educational programs. As always, if you want to listen to the entire interview, if you missed parts of it or want to replay it, you can go to krfy.org to the podcast section. It'll be up later today. Jack, if you're listening, I just promised that. Tune in to the morning show every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for more interesting local voices and projects going on. I want to thank our guests, Kara Johnson, for coming on today. Thank you, Kara.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And Brianna, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
We're going to segue now to a little bit of Walking Jim with his Forever Wild, The Roses of Prince Charles.